Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in for this episode with Colleen Sullivan. Remember, new shows are posted every Monday and Thursday. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes and YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review on iTunes. Before I play today's interview for you, I want to give a shout out to the great sponsors of Futures Radio Show: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. To learn more about these sponsors and the important things they are doing for futures traders, be sure to click on their logos on our website. In this episode, I spoke with Colleen Sullivan, CEO of CMT Digital. Colleen's a rock star when it comes to crypto asset trading, blockchain technology investments, and legal policy engagement in the crypto asset and blockchain technology industry. We chatted about a lot of topics today, from traditional commodity exchanges to crypto exchanges, the missing infrastructure in crypto exchanges, decentralized exchanges versus centralized exchanges, and we talked about the current regulatory environment for crypto assets in the US. We talked about Bitcoin versus Ethereum, VC capital for crypto and blockchain, and of course, we talked about Bitcoin futures. As usual, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Colleen, welcome to Futures Radio Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you, Colleen. And we're going to be focusing a lot today on crypto asset trading and a lot going on in the crypto space. But first off, I want our audience to get to know you a little bit better. Talk to us a little bit about your experience in the crypto space and tell everyone what you guys are doing at CMT Digital.
Sure. I first started reading about Bitcoin in 2012, and in late 2013, I brought up the potential of Bitcoin as an investment for the CMT Group, which is the parent company of CMT Digital. The two founders of the CMT Group, which is a 21-year-old proprietary trading and investments firm based in Chicago, were a little bit hesitant to invest in an unregulated asset that was trading only in unregulated markets. But the two founders did encourage me to get involved from a legal and regulatory standpoint, which then led to our involvement in initiatives like the Chamber of Digital Commerce's State Working Group Committee, where we would talk with different states in the United States as they were trying to figure out how to regulate virtual currencies. I also started hosting a series of roundtables, basically going over the need for an industry-led self-regulatory organization for crypto asset exchanges, wallets, and custodians. We participated in Congressional Blockchain Education Day, where we went to Congress and spoke with representatives about blockchain technology. We went with the U.S. Department of Commerce on certified trade missions to the UAE and Singapore to exchange ideas on blockchain technology with government groups and private sector groups. We helped start the Illinois Blockchain Initiative here, which we're really proud of. And all of those legal and regulatory initiatives continue till today. So I didn't really realize it at the time, but that legal work really became one of three critical components of CMT Digital. So CMT Digital is a subsidiary of the CMT Group. We decided to invest in Bitcoin in the beginning of 2016. We then launched a full crypto trading desk at the beginning of 2017. That desk is headquartered here in Chicago, but we also have small offices in Seoul and Tokyo. And then we started investing in operating companies in the blockchain technology crypto asset space in mid-2017. So the three pieces of the business are really the legal policy work, trading, and investing.
I'm pretty interested in the trading desk side of things at CMT. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? Is it just point and click traders? Is there automation? Like, what's going on in the trading side of things?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. So CMT, we do have a high frequency SEC registered broker dealer that also operates out of the Chicago office. So we're used to operating in a highly technical way in the financial markets. The crypto markets, you know, aren't there yet. So it is a mixture of automated trading, point and click, and then strategies range from arbitrage to signal-based strategies to market making.
Can you tell us what markets you guys are most focused on? I'm obviously Bitcoin, but what other ones?
Yeah, so, you know, we tend to focus where there's the most volume and liquidity, which tends to be the top five crypto assets. So you've got Bitcoin, Litecoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, and Ripple. We do go farther down the market cap table and trade in other crypto assets where we see opportunities. And then we are also trading in the crypto derivatives markets, both at CME, CFE, and on some non-US crypto derivatives exchanges.
I want to talk a little bit about the crypto exchanges. And can you talk to us about the differences from traditional regulated equities and commodity exchanges versus these crypto exchanges?
Sure. Yeah. So when we started trading in this marketplace, we sort of did a gap analysis and looked at how traditional equities and commodities exchanges operate globally versus crypto exchanges. And then we developed a set of internal best practices or standards that, you know, we decided we would hold ourselves to, even if we weren't required to do so yet by the regulators. But just to highlight some of the key differences, you know, there's over 100 different crypto spot exchanges globally. And, you know, use of the word exchange can sometimes be misleading because they are certainly not similar to our CFTC and SEC regulated exchanges. Crypto exchanges are open 24/7. The price increments and lot sizes are smaller, which tends to create thinner order books. The technology or how we connect to or write to each exchange differs at each exchange. Also, the exchange technology infrastructure is generally outsourced to cloud providers like AWS. And so this concept of high-frequency trading doesn't really exist yet in the crypto spot market. It's also very rare to see co-location, although Gemini does offer it. There can be material limitations on withdrawals of fiat and crypto. The ability to trade on the exchanges, from a technology standpoint, can be unreliable during the peak trading times when you really need to get on them. There's also events in crypto that we don't see in traditional equities and commodities trading. For example, crypto assets are software, and when you have software upgrades, sometimes you end up with hard forks. And each exchange treats these fork events different. Sometimes they honor the fork, and sometimes they don't. So if, for example, you held Bitcoin on an exchange that supported the Bitcoin Cash fork last August, you would have received the Bitcoin Cash tokens that resulted from the fork. Certain exchanges do not support the fork, so you didn't receive your Bitcoin Cash. Faced with that decision, you may have decided to move your Bitcoin off the exchange onto an internal node to pick up the Bitcoin Cash. This also gets tricky if you want to borrow crypto for trading purposes. So if a fork event happens while you've borrowed that coin, do you have to be aware of the fork, pick up the fork coin, and return the fork coin to the lender? So there's just some nuance in the space that we don't see in the traditional crypto exchange space. Trading fees on crypto exchanges are also higher than we're used to. And I suspect part of the reason for that could be crypto exchanges don't monetize their market data yet. We haven't seen that happen. I suspect it will at some point in the future.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about infrastructure because someone like me who comes from the future side, I know that there's a lot that goes on in the exchanges, in the back offices of clearing firms to provide infrastructure for traders. And you mentioned how some of that is outsourced to cloud providers. And something else you mentioned, which I thought was very interesting, and it's something that I've experienced with these crypto exchanges, is unreliability at times when it's very busy. So someone like you who's really involved in this industry and who knows both sides from the crypto versus the traditional regulated, you know, equities and commodity exchanges, what infrastructure is missing for these crypto exchanges?
To us, the biggest piece of missing infrastructure is what we call prime services. So specifically, there are no prime brokers in the space right now. We don't have mature custody solutions yet. We don't have institutional grade crypto borrow and lending facilities. And we still don't have as institutional grade of trading tools as we need. But to us, the biggest pain point is this prime broker issue. So right now, trading firms like CMT are forced to self-finance at each crypto spot exchange. And that's obviously an inefficient use of capital and coin. So instead of a prime broker serving as our counterparty and looking at our crypto positions on an aggregate or net basis across all the spot exchanges and providing financing to us, we're forced to directly counterparty with each of these exchanges, leave cash and coin on those exchanges to take advantage of trading opportunities. So it's much easier to assess your counterparty risk to a prime broker like ABN versus assessing your counterparty risk to all of these many different crypto spot exchanges. So if an exchange gets hacked, CMT could lose cash and coin that it holds at that exchange. So our counterparty exchange risk assessment, you know, it's a pretty lengthy process for us. In our mind, it's not a question of if, you know, those prime services come into the space, it's just when. I mean, it's all being worked on, and we have no doubt that the space is going to mature into that place. It just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, thanks for explaining all of that, Colleen. I want to stay on the exchanges for now, because to me, I think this is a very important issue. I want to talk a little bit about the current regulatory environment for crypto assets in the United States. What are you seeing right now?
Sure. I mean, so just generally, the way it works today is we have a patchwork of regulations and regulatory bodies that are involved in the crypto asset space. So we've got the 50 states that are governing crypto assets as currencies under their existing money transmitter regimes, or in certain cases, new regimes such as New York with the BIT license. And then at the federal level, we have FinCEN, which treats crypto assets as currency. We have the IRS treating crypto assets as property. We have the CFTC saying that certain crypto assets are commodities, and we have the SEC saying that certain crypto assets are securities. So we've got this patchwork, but when it comes to regulating crypto asset exchanges, you often hear about this gap in regulation. And to clarify what that means, so exchanges like Kraken, Bittrex, Gemini, Coinbase, they're not regulated by the CFTC or the SEC. Instead, FinCEN is their regulator, and they've obtained, you know, they've registered with FinCEN and they've obtained their money transmitter licenses in the states in which they want to operate. The reason that the CFTC does not oversee them is the CFTC's jurisdiction extends only to derivatives on commodities and not the spot commodity market itself. In 2015, the CFTC, in an enforcement action, stated that Bitcoin is a commodity, and it's a spot commodity. So those exchanges that list spot commodities don't have to register with the CFTC, unlike Bitcoin futures, which are listed at the CME and CFE, because those are derivatives on commodities, they have to be traded on an exchange that's regulated by the CFTC. The SEC has more recently taken a vocal role in, you know, crypto assets, stating that many of these assets really are securities, and as such should be traded on a regulated exchange or an ATS, an alternative trading system. So we are starting to see a shift where we think a lot of these crypto spot exchanges will probably add on ATSs, so that they have the ability to trade not only spot crypto, but also any tokens that may be deemed securities.
Can you put the crypto asset market in perspective so we may be better able to understand the factors that regulators are taking into consideration?
Sure, yeah, I always think this is really important. So today when I looked at total market cap of crypto assets, I think it was $290 billion. So I think it's helpful to consider in comparison, the total market cap of Google, a single American company, is $860 billion. The total market cap of the gold market is $8 trillion. And the market cap of global equities is $75 trillion. So we're talking about a pretty small asset class. However, we've seen quite a bit of growth in these markets. So globally, trading volumes across crypto exchanges increased from 100 million a day in December 2016 to 20 billion a day in December of 2017. So we've also seen over the last 18 months, 20 billion has been raised by crypto projects through ICOs. And that doesn't include the amount of capital that's gone into crypto companies through traditional means like venture capital. So we've seen growth, but it's still a small market. And then we have to look at who's trading in these markets. And that growth is still primarily retail. The listing of Bitcoin futures definitely attracted some institutional involvement. But as far as we're aware, that's primarily from proprietary trading firms and, you know, crypto hedge funds. Very large regulated financial institutions are still largely on the sidelines. And then we have to look at where the trading is taking place. And much of the volume is still happening on unregulated exchanges outside of the United States. So from a regulatory standpoint, you're looking at a market that has significant retail versus institutional participation and highly volatile assets that trade largely on unregulated exchanges outside of the United States. However, the market is still small and poses no systemic risk at this time. And then the thing that I tend to think about a lot is that from an economic standpoint, I do think it's important for the United States to participate in this new asset class like it did with the internet. And what we're dealing with right now is this concept of regulatory arbitrage. So unlike with prior industries, there's really nothing that necessarily physically tethers a crypto business to the United States. So we are seeing companies move to jurisdictions where the regulatory environment is more clear. So I tend to think about, you know, how would policymakers and regulators feel if we had perhaps over-regulated the internet and let's say China led and monetized that effort instead of Silicon Valley. If we create too stifling of a regulatory environment in the United States for blockchain technology or crypto assets, I mean, something like that could happen. I also think it's important to keep in mind that crypto blockchain technology is a global phenomenon, so there's only so much any one regulator in any one jurisdiction can do. And then the final thing that I tend to think about here is, you know, we know that in our traditional market, companies are IPOing at much later stages. And that means that retail investors don't have an opportunity to access those companies until much of the value in them has already accrued. So the people or institutions that have participated in that growth are largely accredited investors. So we now have an opportunity with this new asset class to allow retail investors to participate. And I think we need to consider whether wealth is the right factor to determine suitability. When our securities laws were enacted in the 1930s, suitability was determined by an issuer making full disclosure to the potential investor of all material information related to the investment opportunity. And that way, so long as the potential investor had transparency, we trusted that potential investor to determine if the investment was suitable. This concept of using wealth to determine suitability was first introduced in the early 80s. And so with this new asset class, I think there's probably plenty of technologists and developers who don't meet the accredited investor standard, but are, you know, likely very suitable to invest in this space. So it's just, you know, different things to think about for our regulators, you know, just to consider as they're looking at how to regulate the space. It's not easy.
No, it's definitely not easy. And listening to you, I'm getting an education on really what they have to think about when, you know, looking at this regulatory environment. Now, I want to move on and talk about a hot topic I've been seeing a lot of posts on Twitter about, a lot of blog posts on this, and that's decentralized exchanges versus centralized exchanges. And most of us right now are using the centralized exchanges such as Coinbase and Binance and Kraken. And so if you could explain to everybody the difference between a decentralized exchange versus a centralized exchange, and what are your thoughts on everybody talking about these decentralized crypto asset exchanges now?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting one. So generally, centralized exchanges like the ones that you mentioned, they hold custody of the customer's crypto assets. Of course, the customer can move their crypto assets to their wallet if they would like. But generally, like Coinbase, Kraken, Bittrex, they're the custodian of those assets. So there's a trusted third party that's involved with that exchange. Decentralized exchanges, on the other hand, are built to be peer-to-peer. So if I want to trade Bitcoin on a decentralized exchange, I will send that Bitcoin from my wallet to my counterparty's wallet, who will probably transfer ETH or some other crypto asset over to me in return. So everything is peer-to-peer. There's no central trusted party sitting in the middle. So, you know, we think that decentralized crypto asset markets, that they're an important evolution in the blockchain ecosystem. We continue to see a lot of hacks on centralized exchanges, although I should note that even so-called decentralized exchanges can get hacked if the founders create things like backdoors that make the platform vulnerable to attack. We just saw that happen with a decentralized exchange called Bancor. But very generally, the intent of the decentralized exchange is to put the trader back in control of their assets. We've done a lot of research on the current state of decentralized exchanges, and we review a decent amount of investment deal flow in this area. To date, we've not invested in the space. We do trade on decentralized exchanges, but only for the purposes of learning. We're not, the technology, the interfaces, the experience, none of that is really suitable for us yet from a trading standpoint, but we do want to make sure that we understand them. I hear a lot of people say that eventually all trading markets will be decentralized or peer-to-peer. At least for now, I disagree with that. I tend to think that centralized and decentralized exchanges will coexist. This is because unless our current legal framework is significantly modified, large regulated financial institutions will continue to need to trade on centralized exchanges where we have robust KYC and AML checks in place. Firms like CMT Digital that are less regulated, I think, will be able to interact with both pools of liquidity. And just an interesting example here of how nascent these decentralized exchanges or marketplaces are. There is a prediction market called Augur, which launched maybe 3 weeks ago. It's built on Ethereum, and it consists of smart contracts on the Ethereum blockchain. And users from around the world can place bets on prediction markets without any government oversight. So, you can bet on the World Cup, who you think is going to win, all of that. But recently, a marketplace for assassinations was created, where people bet on the fate of politicians, entrepreneurs, celebrities. They also bet on whether terrorist attacks or shootings will take place. And of course, this is generating quite a bit of debate regarding the morality, ethics, censorship resistance. Who and how can you hold someone liable for something like this in a decentralized setting? So there's a lot of issues that still need to be thought about and worked out in this space.
You mentioned that something was being built on Ethereum. It seems like most everything I read about is being built on Ethereum, which is one of the reasons why I continue to look to buy Ethereum in spots versus Bitcoin, which to me, like I said, I'm just a trader in this space, but I read so much more going on with Ethereum versus Bitcoin, but yet Bitcoin is still the one that's talked about the most. Am I wrong for thinking that more things are being built on Ethereum versus Bitcoin?
Oh, no, you're completely right. I mean, Bitcoin is really primarily used just for, peer-to-peer transfer of value, so of Bitcoin, and you don't really see applications being built on the Bitcoin blockchain. You're right, though, that it's predominantly where people invest. I think, I didn't check, but I think Bitcoin was around 45 to 47% of the total crypto asset market cap. Ethereum is the second largest. Ethereum, on the other hand, was really built to be a platform where applications could be built on top. So, you're absolutely right with what you're seeing there. And what we're starting to see is new protocols like Ethereum coming out where the developers have said, okay, these things were challenging with Ethereum, whether it's scalability, governance, whatever it may be. So we're building a new protocol to address some of those, you know, things that we think need to be improved. So I feel like we're starting it to move into a world where we're going to see many different blockchains protocols coming to market. And the key then is going to be, how do we then make these protocols interoperable so that they can work together? And, you know, all of this is kind of starting to happen now. So it's going to be fascinating to see where it goes. But Ethereum right now has the strongest developer support and community, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, everything I read and everyone I speak to says just that. But yet I still hear everybody talk about Bitcoin a lot more. So, I mean, I'm curious how that ends up impacting price in Ethereum versus Bitcoin in the long run. I guess that's for a different conversation. But I want to go back to something that you talked about with the decentralized exchanges. And in listening to you talk about decentralized versus centralized exchanges, in my mind, I'm thinking this is where it's going to be going. And like you said, it's not ready yet and it's going to take some time. But what I was thinking about was decentralized exchanges. I think this is a big threat to the centralized exchanges for all the profits that you're hearing them make, all the billions of dollars. Am I wrong for thinking that way? What does this do to change the fee structure and everything that goes on with decentralized exchanges?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. So I think as decentralized exchanges mature and grow, and, you know, and it's not that decentralized exchanges can't put in place KYC and AML kind of vetted liquidity pools. They can, right? So decentralized exchanges, I think, can mature and grow. And maybe they can mature and grow into a place where institutions can come and trade. It's just going to take time. But I think as that happens, I mean, you're absolutely right that from a fee standpoint, I mean, that's obviously very threatening to centralized exchanges. And that could be, you know, what brings fees down in the centralized crypto exchange space. You know, that, and I think once these exchanges figure out that, you know, there's a lot of value in monetizing market data, that'll change things too.
Let's talk about the VC side of things. Give us a perspective of being a crypto blockchain VC.
So our investment thesis, which we tend to stick, you know, pretty close to, is that we look to invest in companies that are building infrastructure in the crypto asset space. So kind of like the plumbing, the roads, the bridges, the tunnels, and then also where we can be strategic, whether that's as a customer or a liquidity provider or in some other way. So I'll give you an example of this. In July of 2014, I was at a conference here in Chicago at the McCormick Place, and Vitalik Buterin, we were just discussing Ethereum, he is the founder of Ethereum, was talking about the Ethereum token sale. And I'm a securities attorney by background, and I was totally confused how this token sale was not done under our securities rules and regulations. I just didn't get it. And so kind of flash forward to 2017 when the ICO market got really frothy. We anticipated that the SEC was likely to step in and say that many of these ICOs were really unregistered securities offerings. So we started actively looking to invest in an alternative trading system that would have the proper regulatory permission set to trade tokens that were deemed securities. And that then led us to an investment in an ATS called Templum, which is run by two really exceptional founders, Vince Molinari and Chris Pallotta. But that investment in Templum, I think, really exemplifies our investment thesis. It's a piece of infrastructure that we felt was missing in the marketplace. And we feel that we'll be a strategic partner to Templum as a member of the ATS. And it also shows how these kind of three parts of CMT Digital work together, where there was this legal issue that kind of made us seek out an investment in the space, and then we can add value from what we do on the trading side.
I want to talk about institutional investing a little bit. I think it was Jameson Lopp or Pomp. They put a tweet out saying Bitcoin doesn't need institutional investors. Institutional investors need Bitcoin. So I want to know what you think about that. And also, what are some factors institutional investors may want to consider with respect to adding exposure to these crypto assets and blockchain technology?
Sure. Well, I like that tweet. So I think, you know, from an institutional standpoint, I think it's important to think about the opportunity cost of waiting to invest. Waiting for these markets to become more mature, waiting for more infrastructure to get built in. Because I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity now, and if you wait for the industry to mature, you may give up some of that potential for upside appreciation. I think institutional investors need to get comfortable with the volatility of this asset class. Now, I don't know for certain, but I would guess that many crypto hedge funds were down 40 to 50% during the last couple of quarters. That is not something you see very often with a traditional hedge fund. So I think institutional investors need to think about how they want to manage that. I also think sizing can be interesting. With the volatility, we had last fall, if a manager allocated a small portion of its portfolio to the crypto space, suddenly that small portion became a very large allocation. Of course, that sizing may have then taken care of itself the last couple of quarters when the markets went down, but it's something to think about. And then broadly speaking, you know, I think there's a lot of value that may come from these new protocols that won't necessarily accrue over into the equity markets. So if you're investing in traditional equities and the S&P, and if a protocol like our chain or Tezos becomes hugely successful, I don't think that value shifts over to the traditional equities markets necessarily. From a trading standpoint, you know, this is still largely a retail marketplace. So in a sense, you have a lot of retail investors who are willing to give you their alpha. So from a trading standpoint, I think that's always interesting.
You mentioned the state of Illinois at the beginning of this interview, and I was just back in my hometown, Chicago, for Traders Expo, and I heard some people talking about the state of Illinois and Chicago and what's happening with them and crypto assets. I'm not really familiar with it as to what's going on there. So talk to us about the role of the state of Illinois and Chicago in this emerging asset class.
Yeah, it's actually something where I'm so proud of what the state did and what the city of Chicago has done in this space. I think it's hard to get government initiatives off the ground, and Illinois really, really succeeded with this. So about 3 years ago, the state recognized that it had an opportunity to act in this space. You know, it saw that New York was losing a decent amount of crypto companies because of the BitLicense, and California was still a little bit in flux with what they were doing from a regulatory standpoint. So Illinois started something called the Illinois Blockchain Initiative, and it's really a three-pronged approach where Illinois put out very clear and concise regulatory guidance that was friendly to the industry. The second piece was the state of Illinois itself is engaged in five different blockchain pilot programs. And the third piece was adding an education component. So the state has done month-long hackathons. They've brought in professors to do smart contract coding classes. They've done banking digital asset seminars. I mean, it's really been a robust effort that was led by Jennifer O'Rourke, who was the Illinois Business Blockchain Liaison, and Cab Morris, who was the head of strategy at the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. Interesting enough, both Jennifer and Cab have now left and have started a company in the blockchain space. But so in addition to that government piece, we obviously have a lot of the trading firms that have entered the space and are trading crypto. But in addition to trading crypto, we also have other blockchain startups in Chicago. There's a company called Block, which offers open source blockchain infrastructure. There's a company called Digital Mint, which manages different crypto asset ATMs. This company, Attest, which is building a network for trusted identity, that's Jennifer and Cab's company. There's a company called Manifest, which wants to use distributed ledger technology to solve 401k plan transfer issues. They just won the University of Chicago New Venture Challenge. So we have this, you know, these companies actually starting here. And then we have kind of the advocacy groups. We've got FinTech Chicago, FinTank, the Chicago Blockchain Center. So I feel like we've got, oh, and then I should also mention the academic institutions. University of Chicago has been really active in the space. DePaul, under the leadership of Lamont Black, has been really active. And then IIT. So I feel like we've got this ecosystem of companies starting here, friendly government rules, and then the different advocacy groups that are kind of helping support the space. So I think what we've got going on here in Chicago and in the state of Illinois is really remarkable.
I want to move on and talk a little bit about Bitcoin futures. I mean, this is Futures Radio Show, so I'm curious, how did the introduction of Bitcoin futures impact the crypto asset marketplace?
So, in a few ways, firms or individual traders that didn't want to trade directly on crypto asset spot exchanges, suddenly had access to Bitcoin exposure through two traditional exchanges regulated by the CFTC. And firms that already had accounts and connectivity to CME and CBO could now trade Bitcoin without taking on, that counterparty risk and, having to worry about storing crypto. You also were able to gain exposure to crypto without holding it. One of the, biggest changes that the future contracts brought about was the ability to short Bitcoin, because in general on crypto spot exchanges, you can't sell crypto short. The futures contracts, we would say, come with a little bit of downside because the volume and liquidity on those exchanges is less than the spot exchanges, and the tick size is much bigger, so like $5 versus a penny. What we experienced is when the futures contracts first opened, there were some restrictions around access. Some clearing firms were limiting the number of customers that could trade futures on day one, while others put in place really extraordinary margin requirements. And, we've seen some of those restrictions lift over time as, these exchanges got more comfortable with the product. And we're hoping on our end that this is just the start. Now that the SEC has pretty much said that Ethereum is a commodity, we're hoping that Ethereum futures will be listed in the near term. And then I should probably also add that in addition to Bitcoin futures on CME and CFE, you can also trade Bitcoin futures on exchanges outside of the United States. Specifically, BitMEX and OKEX are the two exchanges where a lot of that happens. Those exchanges have much higher liquidity and daily volume. They have smaller tick sizes. They have customizable leverage. And the margin for those products is managed by the exchange itself instead of a clearing firm. Some of the products have immediate liquidation features. But those exchanges are not regulated. So, and that's a big difference in this space.
So a question I have for you is, I'm a trader. I trade these crypto assets, and I am very bullish on blockchain technology. And I believe that it's just only going to grow from here. And a question I've asked a lot of people in this space is, can you be bullish on blockchain technology and not bullish on the price of these crypto assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum? So I guess the question I'm asking you is that if Bitcoin and Ethereum, let's just say their prices continue to go lower. I mean, they've bounced a little bit lately, but let's just say they start to go lower. Is that a negative on the industry? And can you still be just as bullish on blockchain? Or is it important that those prices go higher to help the growth of blockchain technology?
I think as the blockchain technology industry matures, it is helpful to have stability in the price of crypto assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. I also do tend to think that crypto assets and blockchain technology are linked. The crypto assets are sort of what fuel use of these protocols. That said, I think, right now we're in a bit of a bear market, and I don't think we've seen the kind of deal flow that we're seeing right now during the prior bull market. The development that is continuing to happen right now is remarkable. And we are seeing just a tremendous exodus of executives from companies like Google, the New York Stock Exchange, LinkedIn, Facebook, Goldman, into crypto startups. So, you know, I think that some instability in the crypto asset market, having a bear market right now, that does not mean that technology is not continuing to grow and innovate. So I think for right now, we're okay with the way things are, but it would be nice to have, you know, some long-term kind of growth in Bitcoin and Ethereum as we move forward.
Colleen, great stuff, but we're not done yet. I have some rapid fire questions if you're ready for those.
Uh-oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't get any prizes for answering these rapid fire questions. All right, everybody, our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. You can access the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. And now you can trade cryptocurrency spot and derivative markets side by side. For more information, please visit tradingtechnologies.com. Colleen, first question, who has impacted your life the most and why?
My dad. So I was fascinated with the markets from a really early age. My dad was a college basketball coach, and he didn't really know what to do with me. So when I was in high school, he got me an internship at the Chicago Board Options Exchange, where one of his former high school players worked. I worked for a company called First Options for like 7 or 8 summers, ranging from like phone clerk, runner, clerk in the IBM pit, clerk in the OEX pit. And that really set the foundation for, you know, what I did with my career.
What's the most difficult thing that you've had to overcome in the financial services industry?
After law school, I co-founded a company with two of the traders that I knew from the options exchange, and it was to teach people with employee stock options how to hedge them with listed options. The problem was it took us 7 years to get a rule change through the SEC so that employees could use their vested options as good collateral in those listed options transactions. So we essentially had to close down the company. From that failure, I learned a lot about not building a business on a fragile legal foundation, which is probably what's made me so passionate about the legal work in this space. Additionally, one of my investors was the CMT Group, and we all know how that turned out in the long run. It was very fortunate.
How has your trading evolved over the years?
So I'm like a crypto maximalist now. I pretty much only invest in crypto. And I think it's kind of funny. I have 3 kids. I have a 13-year-old and 2 12-year-olds, and they all have wallets with Bitcoin in them, and they don't have bank accounts.
What's the number one resource you spend your time on?
So in this space, probably crypto Twitter and crypto Telegram.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
Den of Thieves. So it's a book by James B. Stewart, came out in 1991, and it was all about the insider trading allegations and prosecutions of Mike Milken and Ivan Boesky.
What's your favorite movie or TV show about trading or the markets?
So in the crypto space, it's probably The Dark Web, which is a documentary about the Silk Road. It's directed by Alex Winters and narrated by Keanu Reeves. And they were both the stars of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is like my second favorite movie.
What's the best piece of advice that you've received about trading or the markets?
So don't invest more than you can lose. And then when it comes to charting and technical analysis, someone once said to me, even the Titanic had charts.
Now, if you could give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading or the markets, what would it be?
Sure. I mean, in the crypto space specifically, I think it's really important to learn by doing. So I would take a very small portion of your assets and onboard at a Coinbase and just try, buy a small amount of Bitcoin and just understand how the process works.
Last question for today. If you weren't in the crypto space, you'd be doing what?
I would be a comic book illustrator for sure. I love to draw and I love comics.
Cool. Where can people find you on social media and give us a website to check out?
Sure. So we are cmt.digital and our Twitter handle is cmtdigitallimited.
Yeah, everybody, you got to go check out what they have got going on at CMT Digital. Colleen, this was awesome. I had so much fun. Learned a lot from speaking with you today. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.